welcome to the Roundhouse Podcast. This is Paul Sullentrop of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. Today we have Shane Dennis to talk Shocker baseball. Drawing near, we've got games scheduled next week, February 19th, a three-game series against Northern Colorado at X Stadium, and we'll see how the weather unfolds. Shane Dennis is, of course, one of the television and radio voices of Shocker Athletics and co-hosts Sports Daily from 9 to 11 on KFH, 1240 AM, 97. FM. So, Shane, let's talk baseball. The Shockers, 13-2 last year before the shutdown. That team really played what I would describe as clean, fast, pleasing baseball. Lots of pitching, lots of defense. How does a coaching staff go about duplicating that kind of spirit and tempo that they played with last year?
Well, I would say, the proof is in that 12-game winning streak. If you use that as your barometer going forward, you know, that was Eric Wedge's kind of trial run. And he's got a nice little sample size to look back on and say, hey, you play my way, our way, that's what we can be. That's what we can do. So Louisiana Tech sweep in there, I believe. There was a trip to Reno that there was kind of an impromptu game with a couple different or a little series with a couple of different teams. Pass that test. excuse me. And really bounce back from, we forget about this, they got shut out 11-0 opening day or opening night and immediately flushed that. And I was really anxious to see how Eric would handle that in his debut, but was very, I thought, professional in the way that I was able to determine he ran the team. Tells guys the truth, is honest with them, and you know, that's, it sounds like a cliche, but that's kind of a refreshing way to run things, especially a guy that's used to be, you know, coaching men and professionals. But that little 15-game trial run was pretty impressive.
What would you think the biggest difference is between being a big league manager and then coaching 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds? How do you change your message? How do you change how you go about your job, do you think?
Well, if they're not cutting the mustard in pro ball, you get somebody else. You call somebody up or you the organization signs somebody. You got what you got in college. And in Eric's case, he got what was handed to him. You know, so it was, all right, see what we can get out of the hand that we've been dealt, and then we'll move forward from there. I wouldn't have wanted that challenge, or, you know, any college coach. That's their challenge when they go to a brand new place. So, but there are some things that it doesn't matter if it's professional, amateur. I think guys want to be coached, or gals. I think the good ones do. They want to be coached. They want to be told the truth. And they want a legitimate shot of getting playing time. And it doesn't matter at what level. That's all an athlete could ask for. And I think Eric gives that opportunity to all these guys on his team.
2019, the pitching staff's ERA was 5.39. And if I calculated this correctly, the Shockers walked 5.2 batters per nine innings. 2020, they cut that ERA to 2.91 and walks down to 3.5. How did Mike Pelfrey make such a quick correction to this pitching staff? Short, small sample size, only the 15 games, but it was very impressive for what they got.
Short answer is I don't know. Because let's take a look back at what Mike Pelfrey was as a pitcher. First of all, he was a 10-year big leaguer and is the kind of guy that, and I've had coaches like this in my career, that could much easier show you how to do something as opposed to telling you how to do something. And I think Mike probably still could. I don't know how his arm is, but he probably still could show these guys what he wants done. All the more impressive that he was able to teach these guys what needed to be done. You say it was a small sample size, but I think it was big enough for Liam Eddy and Preston Snavely to show that their improvement. Eddie was all right, you know, anyway, but he had some room to grow, and he really took a huge step. I don't expect him to have a 1.73 ERA again this year, but he did last year. And Preston Snavely, he was the guy for me that I was like, wow, if this is the real Preston Snavely, then bravo. And I guess you'd have to ask Mike exactly what buttons he pushed, but for a successful big leaguer as a position coach to be able to impart his knowledge the way he did with those guys last year, like I said, I don't know how he did it, because a lot of times that doesn't translate when you were a great player to teach your position group to try to be great. It's not that easy, but he made it look easy last year.
Almost every important contributor is back. I think Jacob Catsby may be the only person of any note from the starting lineup or the usual lineups that is not back. There's several additions, some transfers, some freshmen who are going to push for playing time. What position areas are you most interested in seeing how they play out?
Number one, probably who else catches besides Ross Cadena. He's kind of been an iron man, and the coaching staff had a lot of trust in Ross and Eric, you know, being a former catcher, no surprise there. But who catches beyond him, I'll be interested to see who that second catcher is, because as I'm sure we'll talk about here in a bit, the doubleheaders are back on the docket with the league game, so Cadena's probably not going to catch all four games on the weekend. It would be that one. And generally speaking, though, because of what you said, everybody's back. In addition to the recruiting class that came in, I feel like the offense, the position players, will have a depth that we haven't seen in a long time. It'll be a fight for who gets at-bats from the position player standpoint. I think they'll have a little more power. You know, it looks like Garrett Kosas, Hunter Gibson, and the health of Paxton Wallace will intrigue me too, because if he's right, if he's back and gets back into the lineup wherever they decide to play him, there'll be some pretty good depth in that lineup from top to bottom. But probably the catching position, to answer your question most specifically, who catches besides Ross Cadena?
I was thinking about the four-game series and how it affected pitching, but yes, the catcher would also be something there. You mentioned Paxton Wallace, who did not play last year with injuries, is healthy and practicing, probably play third base, play first base. Yeah, what can he add to the lineup? He was preseason all-conference, you know, last year before the injuries kept him out.
Well, I think he gives a balance to it. I don't know how they're going to, you know, fill out the lineup card specifically, but if you want to put him between Kosas and Gibson, who are left-handed hitters, you can balance out the lineup a little bit and keep opposing head coaches from stacking their relievers, you know, when it's seventh, eighth, ninth inning. He can provide some balance and some pop from the right side. When he's going good, ball sounds different off his bat. And I've heard that he, like you said, he has been healthy, he's looked good. And I just felt bad for him for the longest time last year, because he had this, I guess, mysterious back injury that nobody could really pinpoint what it was, to my knowledge anyway, and how long he'd be out. And it was, I'd come to the yard every day asking about it, you know, and it's like, nah, he's still out. Nobody knows. He's day to day. So, but he's a difference maker from the right side. And like I said, I'm looking forward to see how much, if they are able to play the entire season, how many doubles and home runs this bunch will hit, because I think potentially there's a lot in there.
When I talked to him in the fall, he had really, you know, done a lot of work on core strength, flexibility, had been swimming really, you know, really trying to work hard to get healthy. When we think about the pitching staff, the weekend rotation returns, you mentioned Liam Eddy, who had a fabulous year. Preston Snavely was really good. Jake Hamilton was a newcomer last year. And then we're going to need a four-starter when we get to conference play. There's a couple transfers that will probably figure into that. Spencer Hines, transfer from Houston.
Yep.
Gareth Stroh, a transfer from Nebraska. Both are lefties. How do you see the pitching staff shaking out? What are you interested in there?
That would be a crowded bunch, too. And I think the two guys that you talked about, I'm looking for one of them. If they both emerge, that'd be great, I suppose. The old good problem to have thing, if they both are weekend worthy. I can remember watching the kid from Houston in the fall and thinking, if this is a normal spring, this would be a really good Sunday guy, you know, if it shapes up that way. Or, but, you know, four-game series, I'm sure both of those guys in some way will have to contribute, because, you know, there's doubleheaders in there, you never know. But I'm pretty good authority that whoever the number one is that Wichita State goes with will be their Friday, you know, as college vernacular goes, the Friday guy. And they're not going to necessarily hold him out and jumble up the rotation depending on if it's a doubleheader or not. I think they'll go pretty much by the book who they believe their 1, 2, 3, and 4 guys are. But those, you bring up those two transfers, those two guys I'm really looking at.
Freshman Jace Kaminsky is a guy I heard a lot about in the fall. Did you get much of a look at him and have any impressions?
No, I just heard the buzz, just like you. And talking to Mike Pelfrey a little bit, I know he's high on him, so he probably will figure into the mix too.
What other newcomers are you interested to see? A few that I have become familiar with, I really liked watching shortstop Andrew Stewart. He's quite a defensive player. Gareth Brothers, Seth Strobe. I thought by the end of the fall, he really had some, you know, really looked good. I enjoyed watching him run and him play out in center field. And then outfielder Corrigan Bartlett also had a nice fall transfer from St. Louis University. Probably play either left or right field. Who jumped out at you, or who are you interested in seeing?
Stewart is the guy that I actually got to see a decent amount, maybe a stretch, but got a chance to watch him play summer ball because he played around here. And he seemed like the throwback shocker. You know, I don't want to go Kevin Hooper on you here, but
he does wear number one.
And he's small and all that stuff. I know.
And he's from Lawrence. So
yeah, that's true too. Yeah,
he's got a lot going toward Kevin Hooper. Yes,
but if there's a shocker way or a thinking back to yesteryear of the, you know, the guys that have dirt all over their uniform, Andrew Stewart is probably that prototypical guy. But I saw a pretty solid defensive shortstop, and you don't have to have a they can't all hit 350, and you don't need them all to hit 350. And I'm not saying that he can't, but if he plays a solid shortstop, if he ends up getting the job there, then I would say he'd be the newcomer I got my eye on.
Well, here's another throwback reference. Should they let Cooper Elliott just go Mike Jones and play all 9 positions in a game this spring?
Yes. I 100% would back Cooper Elliott to playing all of the positions.
Because I understand he's catching, or he has caught.
I've seen him catch. Yeah, I saw him catch in the fall. And when I first noticed it wasn't Kadena, I was like, who's this guy? And I'm like, oh, that's Cooper. And so, you know, I think he started catching bullpens just to help, just to try to contribute in any way he could. But he looked okay to me. Catching, as hard as that might have been to believe, you know, 2 years ago or whatever. But, yeah, I was here when Mike Jones did that, was I not? Is that a 1991 thing?
Yeah, he would have been a freshman in 89, I think. He was a freshman on that team, and then probably as a senior farewell, he played all 9 spots.
Yeah, I would have been there.
Yes, thank you for cleaning up that history. I always do I make these references, and then I understand that, you know, 60% of the audience has no idea what I'm talking about. So, yes, Mike Jones.
I'll try to fill in the blanks for you, Paul.
Mike Jones, East High, played at Wichita State, and at one point did everything. Played all 9 spots in a baseball game for the Shockers.
And pretty darn good receiver, really, too, because I remember throwing to him. I'm like, man, that's not bad for a third baseman, but he caught a fair amount in 91 when Doug didn't.
Yeah, he was a very good player. Mm-hmm. I think he was, you know, it was not some gimmick.
I
think he played third base on the championship team after the injuries got him, and then he was a regular starter on those teams in the early 90s. Is there a series or a game, maybe first month, first half of the season, that you are looking forward to that you think may really tell us something about the Shockers?
Probably the easy answer is Arizona, because they're supposed to be good, you know. And they're down there. The games are down there. It will be, I don't know, help me. Will that be their first major roadie? I know they go to ORU for one game, but it's either that or I think it is. It's either that or the trip to Florida, but I think the one to Arizona is first. But because of what they're supposed to be, Arizona, and what I suppose by then we'll know if that 13-2 last year was real or not. I would think that Wichita State would be something close to 13-2 after 15 games without, you know, circling W's and L's too early. But I think the no-brainer is that trip to Arizona if the Wildcats are to be what we think they are.
And that is March 11, 12, 13th, and 14th down in Tucson. It's their first road trip, yes. They play at ORU, but that's a single, that's a single game. The draft will be, it's always interesting to talk about. It appears that in July we will go back to more of the traditional draft, 20 or 30 rounds. I wasn't able to see that it was locked in. But we had a lot of shockers who, you know, at this time a year ago would have said, you know, I'm gonna be drafted, and this will be my last year in college. I know Liam Eddy, Jake Hamilton, mm-hmm. both of them, probably others. So now they're coming back. You know, for another year, expanded draft. So what I'm getting to is that can always be an interesting thing for guys to go through. What's the best approach? What did you observe? Who handled the looming draft the best during your time at Wichita State?
Well, that's a good question. Who handled it the best? I handled it pretty well because I got drafted as a junior and I was terrible. And decided to come back, and it turned out to be kind of a fairy tale, the ending anyway. But in my experience, I knew that if I signed as a junior after I was two and whatever, I wasn't in a great place. And so I didn't think that I thought that far ahead as far as am I ever going to make it to the big leagues, but I was never serious about signing with Toronto. After my junior year, I was pretty much 100%. I'm going to go back to school. Wasn't all that worried about getting drafted. Figured I'd get a chance to play. And that's all you really want anyway, besides a little money in your pocket. But if you just get a chance to play professional baseball, that's the whole thing. And I knew I wasn't ready then. Now, as far as these guys, those that didn't get drafted last year, because there's only, what, five rounds?
Right.
Okay, so there are plenty of guys off of this team that would have gotten drafted, and they would have had a decision to make. Some of them, we don't know who and won't know until, you know, this time next year. Some of them, if given the opportunity, probably should have signed and gone and played because there's no guarantee, and I'm not saying this is just an example, there's no guarantee that Liam Eddy is going to do what he did last year. And which in his case, and in that case, probably he should have been gone when the getting was good, but he didn't have the opportunity. You know, and some people can have a setback or just not be as good as the year before or not flash what the scouts wanted to see the year before. It's complicated. It's weird. It's an inexact science. Every draft is. But in my experience, I knew I wasn't ready. In some of these guys' cases, I'm sure they wanted to go. But didn't have the opportunity, so they're going to make the best of it this year. I feel bad for them.
Draft has traditionally been in early June, where it kind of has the potential to muck up the end of a college season. Do you like it better being in July? Is that, you know, maybe an extra month of separation? Will that help college baseball players?
I'm for it. Yeah, it's distracting for some. Now, not everybody in that draft pool obviously is playing in regionals or supers or the College World Series. So, but I'm for it. I'm for a later draft, and I'm less against change now than I used to be anyway. And if there's some good solid logic behind it, like putting a guy at second base in the 10th inning to lead off an inning, hey, all right, let's try it. Let's get weird. But yeah, later draft I'm okay with.
You would have played obviously in the minor leagues. Do you have strong opinions about Major League Baseball's constricting of the minor league system?
Not all those teams were necessary. At the low levels, there were only, I don't even know if a handful is the correct way to put it, but there were only a few guys from those teams that were actually going to make it all the way to the big leagues. So, you know, like I said, I'm more open to change nowadays than I used to be, but all those minor league teams at the low levels were not necessary. I'm okay with the constricting of and the eradication of some of those teams, as sad as it is for some of those minor league towns.
Yeah, I guess that would be my concern. You're giving people less of a reason to get involved in baseball. I would think that would be a concern if you're major league baseball. But
well, you know what, though? Unless you had a brand new stadium, I mean, there were plenty of places I played in the Midwest League where there wasn't a whole lot of interest in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to go watch the Colonels play, you know, unless it was free hot dog night or fireworks, you know. So I guess I would counter that with, you know, these places maybe, if they'd put their money where their mouth was, or, you know, draw and make it near impossible to take away minor league baseball from you, then that would have done the trick. But, you know, money talks both ways.
Shane, you are not standing up for the romance of a summer night in the Appalachian League.
I'm almost 50. I should be going the other way.
Yes, you should be nostalgic for those times, and you're not. We talked about the four-game weekend series, which the American is going to as a way to get in games. No midweek games, which is both a measure to save pitching staffs and stop COVID delays. You would have experienced the four-game weekend series in 91 in the Missouri Valley Conference. How does that affect a pitching staff?
You better be fairly deep. Sundays could get ugly. You and I talked a few days ago about the strategy of who you pitch when, and that's maybe more so for a regional back in the day where you wouldn't necessarily throw your number one on the first day. You'd save him for this particular day, whatever. But your staff, your depth, that's why we were so good. We could handle – we actually had a four or five-man rotation when I was here. You want me to go nostalgia? We'll throw back. Back in my day, we had five starters, and it showed in the league. Our scores most of the time weren't 11-10 on Sunday like everybody else's were, because we had legitimate starters that were groomed for that. And a shout out to Brent, you know, for creating a pitching staff that looked like a professional staff. This is your day. It's your turn. You're gone. And not just bring a guy back because he's the best guy that we have. We had four or five guys most of the time when I was here doing the four games in 3 days thing. It's grueling. It makes for a long weekend, but the better and deeper your pitching staff, the better off you're going to be. That's the easy answer.
Right. That's Brent Kimnitz, former pitching coach, who has been largely forgotten.
Yes.
Into the dustbin of history with Brent Kimnitz. Yes. So I appreciate you bringing his name up. Yeah, the four-game series, is it tiring just to be at the ballpark that much? It sounds fun. I think fans can enjoy it because it is a ton of baseball, but from a player's perspective, does it get tiring being there that much?
It does. And you're expected to, especially if you're a position player, to be on your toes, ready for the ball to be hit to you, regardless of this is your 17th inning and your fifth hour of standing out there, ball hit to you may be the difference in that particular game. So yes, that is a thing. It's a long, that doubleheader day and the Sunday game of your fourth and 3 days, those are when you really get tested.
I glanced through some schedules. It looks like some schools are going to the doubleheader being the first day.
Yeah, I don't know if that's set in stone or not. And I looked at Wichita State's schedule, and it kind of went back and forth depending on where we go, whether it's here or there. So yeah, I thought that was, I noticed that as well. I don't know if it'll stay that way or not.
Interesting. I hope that's just a one-year thing. It makes sense. You got to get in. At this point, you just want to get in games, so go for it. But I think ideally a three-game weekend series makes more sense. Let's talk about the American Athletic Conference race. We've got East Carolina, the preseason favorite. I think they've been probably the leader in the American over the last few years. They're ranked in most of the polls as high as number 13. We've got the Shockers picked fifth. Liam Eddy and outfielder Cooper Kornblum are on the preseason all-conference team. UCF also getting some national rankings. How do you handicap the conference?
I'd say that's it. Cliff Godwin, I think, is the guy at ECU. Really impressed with him, and he's been building that thing for quite a while. I feel like they'll always be tough, and you know nothing's automatic nowadays, but that's who I would have said. ECU, UCF, and it seems to me like Houston is always somehow better than the sum of their parts. You look and you think, I thought they were a little short in multiple positions the last 2 years, and yet they managed to win games and managed to beat us too, as a matter of fact. So they're, I suppose, my dark horse if I had to handicap the race there. But I think Wichita State's, in at least on paper, in good position to give all those guys a run. I don't know if they can win the thing, but they can scare some people. And the other thing too, Paul, about the 4 games in 3 days thing, it's a lot harder to sweep now. So your outlook on a successful series kind of floats around during the course of a weekend. You sweep the doubleheader, okay, now you can get greedy. But this is a type of league that's hard to sweep regardless if it's a 3-game series, but now it's even tougher. So I think you're going to see ECU with a few more losses than you would expect when you look at them when they're 0-0.
The American was doing well last year before things got shut down. Tulane was 15-2. The Shockers 13-2. UCF had either swept or won a series at Auburn, and they were 15-3. The Pirates were 13-4. And then the interesting thing about this year is I think it's easy to look at your team wherever you are and say, well, we were pretty good last year and we got everybody back.
Right.
Well, but everybody has a lot of guys back. How do you factor that into your thinking?
I don't know. And, boy, that's 2 or 3 I don't knows. That's bad bad podcast answer, isn't it?
That's all right. No, you're being honest. You're not.
Throughout the country, everybody's got this issue that they're dealing with. And even if you wanted to leave here and go somewhere else, I don't know why that would be a good jumping off point. So that's probably why you see so many coming back on this team. But I imagine it's the same for everybody else. So I guess the caveat there is just because you're a year older doesn't mean you're going to be a year better. We're not all going to get better. Some are going to regress. But if you at least have the core of this particular Wichita State team from last year at least duplicate what they did the year before, then, yeah, I think there's a lot of reason for optimism. But I know everybody's saying that now, too. You bring up a good point. Everybody is saying, well, we ought to be better next year because of what we got returned.
Yeah, this may turn out. We may find out there were some unique coaching challenges where you had to manage bigger rosters, bigger, more people with expectations. All those kind of things may come into play this year.
And the only 5 rounds of the draft kept a lot of people around, too.
Right.
That would have poached a few of the better players on every team.
Yeah, from a talent perspective, this should be a great year for college baseball.
Yes.
Because you're going to see guys who, last year or normal year may have been a 7th-round draft pick. They may be back, and some of them are going to be better. Favorite Shocker nickname from your playing days? Let's keep the nostalgia going. you guys were famous for your nicknames. What was your favorite Shocker nickname from your playing days?
That was Brent. That was Brent Kimnitz again. He gave everybody, I don't want to say everybody because I didn't have one. I didn't have a nickname. But Matt Klusner was Edgar because he looked like Edgar Winter, according
to
Brent.
The guitarist, rock musician.
Edgar Winter group.
Okay.
So his nickname was Edgar. The Bluma brothers were all Bundy. I didn't get that one. It started with Jeff, who Brent thought looked like Ted Bundy, the serial killer. I didn't see it. I thought Brent stretched it because of his fondness for serial killers.
Right.
He famously tracked a BTK case for all those years here in Wichita. So I thought that was a stretch, but Jeff was Bundy. Jamie was Bundy Jr., and I assume I wasn't here
for Mark,
but I assume he was just Bundy. Darren Dreifert was Durwood because on Bewitched, the guy named Darren was erroneously called Durwood by the mother-in-law.
Right, he was mocked as Durwood, yes.
So Darren's nickname was Wood, and that's where that came from.
Okay.
Mike Jones was Cool Breeze. Doug Mirabelli was Vincent Crenshaw. Did he kill somebody too, I think?
I've never heard of that name. So
okay, he was Vinny.
That reference is.
So I imagine he killed somebody. Jeff Williams, before I got here, was Seek. That was the last name of somebody that was a serial killer too, I think. So you might ask Brent about this, examine a little further why he was naming us after people that killed people.
Interesting. I had not heard this part about the nicknames.
There
you go.
You take it and run with it and do with it what you will. But almost everybody that had a nickname, it was because somebody died.
Brent was the purveyor of the nicknames.
Yes.
Best card player on the long bus trips to Carbondale or Evansville. Or Evansville wasn't in the league, I guess, when you were
playing. I was the director of ops.
That's true.
I was on a bus to Evansville.
You went to Evansville.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, boy. Doug Mirabelli was pretty good. And myself and Steve Smith won our share of tournaments. So I'll throw myself into that mix. But you had to go through Gene and JT. They were going to be there in the championship round, or if you thought you were a good spades player, you had to play G and JT. They were really good.
Okay.
And if you knocked them off, then you were doing something. But Steve Smith, excellent card partner, and spades is what we played, by the way. I don't know if anybody ever played hearts. I think after I was gone and when I was the director of ops, there was more poker playing or some facsimile thereof in the back of the bus, but when I played, everybody played spades. And we had a tournament because we had nothing else to do for 10 hours.
Did Gene and JT take their defeats gracefully?
No. Most of the time, Gene blamed JT for losing. So they would fracture when you had them on the run. A lot of finger pointing. But on the other hand, if you got over on them, there was the microphone just a couple of feet away that you could announce, you know, what just happened up there in case none of the other 30 guys could hear from the yelling and screaming or the backbiting. But, yeah, they were hard to beat, but when they fell, they crumbled.
They
fell apart at the seams, yes.
And I guess for nostalgia purposes, we should say that cards was a game played before video games,
yes,
before phones.
Smartphones,
kind of,
yes.
Small pieces of kind of hard paper in your hand.
52 of them.
52, yes. Cards.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yes. Kind of a game of skill and a little bit of luck, a little bit of chance. I know when volleyball team embarks on long bus trips, they load up on food. People bring all kinds of stuff. Did baseball players bring food on these long trips? And who brought the best homemade cookies or whatever?
That was a treat. And now we're having to differentiate between when I played and when I was a director of ops. And a lot of water went under the bridge. You know, I was young and then old. So usually, and I'm trying to think of who it was, usually somebody was responsible for having either their mom or, you know, if they lived in town here, have them bake the cookies. Maybe Chris Wimmer's mom was good at that because he's from here. And I think maybe there were batches of cookies courtesy of Wimmer's mom. But I don't know that anybody had that, you know, torch, you know, that you're responsible for the snacks. It wasn't really big when I played because we usually would stop at some point, like in Columbia, and then we'd all run to the convenience store and pick up, you know, whatever it is that we wanted or needed. Now, more recently, there have been meals served on the bus on the way out of town, so the snacks aren't really as necessary. You know, instead of stopping somewhere for lunch, they'll have box lunch ready for you. So I've kind of ran the gamut of snacks and food on my bus trips. And I've, golly, now that I think about it, I've been on a lot of them. So it's, I don't know if it's evolved, but it's changed. And I was never really a big snack guy anyway. I could usually wait until we got to Columbia.
Which Major League Baseball team had the best offseason?
Padres. The Padres have turned into probably the biggest threat to the Dodgers. So I'll go with them.
Okay. Last question. I found it interesting to talk to broadcasters about what it's been like to broadcast from their booth, from their enclosure. You started out, no crowds. We're kind of slowly getting more and more people. What's it been like? Same, different? How's that experience going?
How we have it here at the arena is like the plexiglass. I wasn't too bothered by that. Bob Hall and I did the Oral Roberts game, the men's game. I think that was my first, but I'm not sure. But I wasn't bothered by it at all. I thought it was fine. Now, I haven't done it anywhere else except for the tunnel, the Mike Kennedy game, whereas Dave and I doing the road game at Houston here, that was nerve-wracking. And I battled succumbing to the, what if the screen I'm looking at goes black, thought that crossed my mind. And I had a little mini panic attacks, and luckily flushed them really quick. But watching that monitor, or doing it from home like a lot of people do, I don't know about that, man. I don't know. I suppose you could get used to it, but not being able to see everybody, not being able to see the bench, you're at the mercy of where that camera is going, is not the same and not cool. I did not enjoy that at all. But in the arena experience, you get used to the 100 fans that are there, or you get used to the 1,000 fans that are there, because you can at least see everything. So I've been okay with the broadcasting in a pandemic experience.
And so you're speaking about the remote broadcasting, which even before the pandemic, that was kind of a growing thing.
Yeah.
ESPN would do it from, I think, Charlotte, or maybe their Disney complex down in Florida. So when you're doing that, do you have any input, any control at all over the cameras, or are you totally at the mercy of what is shown?
In my one game experience, I had no input at all. The best that we could do was request natural sound from the folks that were producing the game down in Houston. They could feed us certain things within reason, but no, not the on-the-court product. You just followed and you tried to describe it as best you could, and I was glad when it was over.
Thank you for listening to the Roundhouse Podcast, courtesy of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. We appreciate your time. We encourage you to rate, review, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, such as on iTunes or Google Play. You can find more Roundhouse content at GoShockers.com. Thank you for listening.
And they let him pass it up court, and then it gets picked off. A long three by Pangos, no good. 1 second, it's over. It is over, and Wichita State has beaten the number one team in the nation to go to the Sweet 16. Go crazy, Wichita. I know you are.